Anyway, we'll try and finish it off and make some sense out of it. Alright, so we saw last week how the third critique, the critique of judgment, attempts to discover the a priori but imminent conditions for an aesthetic judgment. This means showing how and why particular empirical representations cause pleasure or displeasure, not because of subjective interests or tastes, nor because of something that is in the object, but as reflective judgments. Judgments that are about particular experiences that allow us to understand the a priori necessity and universal applicability of the feelings that they provoke. So in other words, Kant is interested, like he is in the first two critiques, in finding the universal conditions of experience, this time feelings, the experience of a feeling, of pleasure or displeasure. Whereas the first critique is interested in the conditions of the understanding, of having a concept, and the second critique is interested in the conditions by which we are able to perform a moral act. So, in an aesthetic judgment of the type, this is beautiful, the imagination is freed from its subordination to the understanding. This is the subordination which is explained in the first critique, in the case of understanding. It's freed from this subordination to the understanding because a reflexive judgment about beauty does not appear under a concept that determines it. The understanding is, of course, still required for there to be a perception, but the understanding operates in an indeterminate way in the judgment of taste, inasmuch as it gives the conditions, or a condition, of appearance without the categories legislating over that appearance in order to make it an object of thought. Now, this is a kind of complicated way of saying something rather simple, because an aesthetic judgment is concerning a feeling, it's not concerning a concept. But the understanding still plays a role in that, because for an experience to exist, the understanding has to play a role. But the understanding does not determine that experience in terms of the conceptual categories. Now, Kant kind of gives an example of this when he says, we find a particular rose beautiful. We don't find roses in general beautiful. Yeah? So an aesthetic judgment, as a reflexive judgment, is concerning a particular experience, an experience of a rose. Yeah? Why, he wants to find out, what are the conditions of this experience that are universal? Yeah? So what is the transcendental condition for what? The experience of a beautiful object. Because the imagination is not determined by the understanding and the judgment of taste, the imagination no longer schematizes for the understanding, which is what happens. This is the process described in the first critique. The imagination no longer schematizes for the understanding, but reflects the form of the object. As a result, and as Kant puts it, beauty should actually concern only form. This beautiful form is the particular appearance of an object of nature in its unity or perfection, and expresses what Kant calls the free lawfulness of both nature and the imagination in their undetermined relation to the understanding. Both the perfection of nature's forms and our feelings of pleasure when experiencing their beauty have their source in this free necessity, this is what Kant calls it, which achieves their connection. That is, in the experience of the form, the beautiful form, which is a reflection of the object's form in the imagination, that is, without the legislation of understanding turning this into a concept, we are able to see the way in which this process of judgment and, let's say, the process of nature come from the same type of relation, this free lawfulness that determines both nature and it determines an aesthetic judgment. So this is what he's going to try and show. Kant writes, "Nature's aptitude thus appears as a power without aim, fortuitously adapted to the harmonious exercises of our faculties. As a result, the aesthetic experience of pleasure that beauty gives reflects the perfect design of nature. The reflection, or reflective judgment, that gives us pleasure in the beautiful thereby reveals the supersensible, the transcendental purpose of nature, which is the idea of a transcendental design." This is what I talked about a little bit last week as the purposiveness of nature. This idea that nature is a kind of perfect system in which everything has its place. And it's precisely when we experience a beautiful form that we are able to experience this purposiveness of nature. And it's exactly the fact that our faculties are in a kind of undetermined harmony, free play, as Kant is going to call it, that both allows us to experience the beauty of the form, but which is also a relationship of free lawfulness, as Kant calls it, which is how nature operates itself. This formal beauty reveals what Kant calls the free play of the imagination and the understanding. Formal beauty appears through the relation of these faculties, but in judgments of taste, neither imagination nor the understanding legislates over the other, and they enter a kind of harmony, and it is this harmony which causes pleasure. This pleasure is in turn universal, because it expresses the purposiveness of nature, and as a result, aesthetic judgment shows us how a particular and beautiful form of nature, in being reflected in the imagination, gives rise to a subjective, it's my feeling, but it is nevertheless an a priori feeling, a necessary and universal feeling of pleasure. Beauty therefore reveals the communicability of feeling and the universality of aesthetic pleasure, and so defines a new common sense. Common sense in the aesthetic realm is the disinterested pleasure arising from the free play of the faculties that is universally felt in the experience of the beautiful. This doesn't mean that everyone will agree with the judgment of taste, the judgment of beauty, this is beautiful. It doesn't mean that everyone will agree with that, but it does mean that everyone should agree to it. Deleuze puts it this way. He says, "No one cares if we do or don't like lemonade or cheese." Actually, it's a funny biographical point about Deleuze, because Deleuze is on record as saying he actually hated cheese. And there's a funny episode in What is Philosophy where he talks about dinner parties where people talk about cheese. And he hates this kind of thing. So he hates cheese, but he also says his three favourite foods were sweetmeats, so that's the strange organs of the body, bone marrow, and third, can anyone guess? It's kind of obvious. Brains. Okay. So that was Deleuze's taste. I don't know about that. Okay, so nobody cares if we say we don't like lemonade or cheese. But if we say that we don't like Bach or Mozart, that's something completely different. And that shows no taste in Kant's sense, because the beauty of Bach and Mozart is understood as being a universal beauty, a necessary beauty. Because these things, unlike cheese and lemonade, express the necessity of nature, the perfection of nature. Well, they reflect the perfection of nature. Okay, so this means that the third critique doesn't complete the other two, but rather provides them with their ground. The third critique demonstrates how it isn't possible for one faculty to legislate over the others, whether that's understanding or whether it's reason, without this free subjective harmony of the faculties that emerges in aesthetic judgments, without this being first established. Deleuze writes, this is the first quotation on the list of quotations. Did everyone get a copy of this? People who came in late? There should be some more floating around. All right, Deleuze writes, in two respects then, the critique of judgment releases us in a new element, which is something like a fundamental element. One, a contingent agreement of sensible objects with all our faculties together, instead of a necessary submission to one of the faculties. Two, a free, indeterminate harmony of the faculties among themselves, instead of a determinate harmony presided over by one of the faculties. This comes from an article about Kant that was written after the book, and that's included in the reader. But common sense is also the real difficulty of the critique of judgment according to Deleuze. Those are Deleuze's words, real difficulty. Because it's hard to see what this common sense is actually based on. It can't be found in the categories, as it is in the critique of pure reason, because then understanding would legislate. As a result, it seems as if aesthetic common sense can only be presupposed. But this is, as Deleuze points out, an unsatisfactory solution, he says, that forces Kant to find the genesis, the cause, for this common sense. Deleuze puts it like this. This is the next quotation on the list. The analytic of the beautiful left us with this question. Whence originates the free and determinate agreement among the faculties? What is the genesis of the faculties in this agreement? Precisely, the analytic of the beautiful stops because it does not have the means to answer the question. One notices, moreover, that the judgment, this is beautiful, brings into play only the understanding and the imagination. There is no place for reason. Following the analytic of the beautiful, the analytic of the sublime calls on reason. But what does Kant expect from this? How will this solve the genetic problem related to the beautiful? So this problem of the genesis of common sense is what Kant attempts to solve in his discussion of the sublime, which is what I'm going to spend the rest of today talking about. Okay, so we remember that the imagination performs two syntheses, the synthesis of apprehension and the synthesis of reproduction. Apprehension is the successive apprehension of parts, and when this is subjective, in my intuition of a thing, that is a large thing that I must experience in parts, yeah, one bit after another. When this is subjective, an intuition of a thing, it implies space. And when it's objective, that is my intuition of an event, so in other words, the succession occurs out there, then this implies time. Yeah, it has to happen in time. After this apprehension of parts, whether they are subjective in terms of my apprehension of the object or objective in terms of my apprehension of an event, there is a further synthesis required, which is the reproduction of the previous parts of an apprehension in order to form a complete intuition of the object or the event. In other words, if I can't maintain or keep my previous apprehensions with the successive ones, then the coherence of an object becomes impossible. It means I can't form an object if I can't keep the previous apprehensions together or reproduce them as I continue to perceive. So the reproduction of the previous parts of an apprehension is required to form an intuition, after which the understanding provides the conceptual form of the object itself, which is what Kant calls the object equals X, which unites the spatio-temporal diversity or multiplicity of experience that is given to me by imagination into an object of recognition. Yeah? It's a rose. Make the statement after this process. Now, the pleasure I feel when I judge an object to be beautiful is generated by a free play of the imagination and understanding, as it is neither a concept of thought, which would be when the understanding legislates over the experience, and nor is it simply an empirical representation, which would be just a sense experience, yeah, a sense experience without any kind of judgment applied to it. In order to understand the question as to what causes this free play of the imagination and the understanding that gives me pleasure, Kant returns to this process of experience. He wants to, let's say, go further into this process of experience to try and find its genesis, to try and find what it is that causes it. Yeah? Because, as Deleuze said, it requires a ground, this common sense of the free play of the faculties in the faculty of judgment requires a ground. Okay, so he says, when I apprehend a sensible diversity, I apprehend a succession of parts. It's obvious whether we are apprehending an object or whether we are apprehending an event. We have to experience it in parts. But he says, how do I choose or become aware of these parts as such? In other words, what is it that makes them parts? He says, well, it implies that there must be some unit of measure, some way I'm able to measure them in order to say, well, these are a part of this, or this is a smaller part of this larger part, or these parts make up this whole, and so forth and so on. It means I have to have some kind of way of measuring in order to be able to say that there are anyway parts to my experience in the first place. But this unit of measure, it has to be a sensible unit of measure rather than a conceptual unit of measure, yeah? Such as a meter or a kilometer, because these conceptual measures, like a meter or a kilometer, they're purely abstract and are products of the understanding, not of the imagination. So what then would be a sensible unit of measure? Kant gives various examples. He says, I apprehend a tree according to the unit of the height of man. So I say, for example, this tree is 10 men tall. Yeah? We can see how this is a sensible unit of measure. It's about a unit of measure that is determined by sensible experience, not by an abstract idea of a certain length. Yeah? So he has to keep it in the imagination. All right, so we say this tree is 10 men tall. Then behind the tree is a mountain, which is 100 trees tall. And then we look at the sun and we wonder, how many mountains distance is it? Yeah? So we have these sensible units of measure by which we are able to understand our experience in terms of parts. The thing is, I keep changing my unit of measure according to what it is I perceive. And this means that before I'm able to perform a logical synthesis of parts in an apprehension, I need to make what Kant calls an aesthetic synthesis that determines each part's unit of measure. Okay, what does that mean? Let's say, for instance, that an aesthetic synthesis determines something to be large. Okay, so I make the judgment that this is large. But I can't refer, in making this judgment that something is large, I can't refer to a concept of the understanding, an a priori concept. Nor is it simply just an intuition of sense, because that would only be an experience, it wouldn't be a measurement. Right? Nor can I appeal to a rational concept, that is an idea of reason, because this is always seeking an unconditioned idea. So to say that something is large must refer to a concept that belongs to the power of judgment, belongs to judgment, not to understanding, reason, or to imagination. To judge something as being large, we must compare it to something that acts as its measure. But here is the problem, because we always have to measure the measure. That's what the example of the 10 men is the tree, the 100 trees is the mountain, the million mountains is the distance to the sun, and so forth and so on. Every measure has to be measured. And this means that no magnitude of appearance, that is the judgment, this is large, can ever yield an absolute concept of that magnitude, a concept of large itself, for example. We can't ever say, well, what is, apart from any empirical experience, large? What is that? Well, we can't say that, what it is, because it's only ever relative to whatever our sensible unit of measure is. It's a unit of measure that is only ever comparative. This means that all estimations of a natural object's size are determined by an aesthetic synthesis that remains a subject of judgment. Yeah. We can't find through experience any kind of universal concept of large that could be applied to anything. Yeah? You can only ever find a comparative concept of large that is generated only through and by our subjective experience. But, Kant argues, the sublime is in fact the experience of the absolutely large. Because you see, this is a problem. This comparative nature of the unit of magnitude, in this case large, is a problem for Kant, because Kant is seeking the a priori universal conditions of judgments, aesthetic judgments of feelings of pleasure and displeasure. Yeah? So he's wanting to go, this is the process of reflective judgment, he's wanting to go from a particular sense experience to its universal and a priori condition. So when it was a question of the beautiful, yeah, he was able to achieve this by showing this kind of harmony, not only between imagination and understanding, but between the reflection of the perfection of nature in the form of the beautiful object. Yeah? So this was a way in which he was able to move from the particular sense experience to its universal and a priori conditions. But, as we saw, this common sense, which underlies the ability to move from the particular to the universal, is grounded in a, it's grounded in a common sense which is nevertheless, or appears to be nevertheless, assumed. Yeah, that Kant doesn't show how this common sense actually comes to be. So this is where Kant takes another look at the process of empirical perception in order to try and find what it is that generates this common sense. But in doing this, he comes up against the problem of how is it that we are able to, let's say, ground measurement. Yeah? How are we able to ground, in other words, the apprehension of parts that the imagination performs in order for us to have a sense experience? And in other words, how are we able to get a universal and a priori concept of large, yeah, that would be able to, let's say, act as the register for all of our other judgments of size? Okay, he says, well, in fact, it is the sublime which presents this concept of the absolutely large. In comparison to the sublime, everything else is small. And in fact, the absolutely large of the sublime can, and for this reason, well, we'll see the reasons in a second, this absolutely large of the sublime cannot be an object of the senses, which we have seen, as we have seen, are determined by aesthetic syntheses as the basis of any sensible measure. The sublime is the immeasurable. You cannot measure it. It's absolutely large. Yeah? We can think of the largest possible thing we can think of, and the sublime is larger than that. This means that in our experience of the sublime, the imagination no longer perceives a beautiful form, but is faced with an experience that is formless. There's a sense now that in his search for the ground to the judgment of beauty, he has found something which seems to completely go against the possibility of beauty. Yeah? Because how can a beautiful form, how can the sublime be beautiful if the sublime does not have a form? Yeah? It cannot have a form because it cannot be measured. This means that with the sublime, the imagination is confronted with its own limit. What does that mean? That imagination is confronted with its own limit. Imagination has no limit when it is apprehending, that is, when it is apprehending the successive appearance of parts. Because as long as it has established a unit of measure, and even if this unit of measure changes, it can nevertheless carry on measuring to infinity. Yeah? It can always change its unit of measure. It means that it can go on forever. But imagination reaches its limit when it attempts to simultaneously reproduce this infinity of parts in a comprehension. Yeah, so this is the problem that imagination is confronted with in the sublime, which is that even if it attempts to, let's say, continually raise its unit of measure to infinity, yeah, well, it can try and keep doing that, but when it comes to reproducing all of these apprehensions into some kind of object, yeah, it can't do it, because it's never finished. It's going on forever. So this is the sense of the sublime's formlessness. The sublime cannot be an object because in its infinity it can never be given a form. It can never be effectively measured. So this is where the imagination falters in the face of this kind of sublime totality of nature, which can never be measured through its comparison with something else, because there is always a bigger unit of comparison available within infinity. It's interesting here because there is a kind of a shift in the understanding of nature here, because nature, inasmuch as it is judged to be beautiful, is, let's say, an extensive nature, a nature of forms, a nature of objects in the world. The sublime, however, is a kind of intensive infinity. The sublime is about power. Yeah? And this is the element of nature which cannot be measured. And this is why, of course, the famous examples of the sublime, you know, are landslides, thunderstorms, kind of various apocalyptic, you know, natural occurrences. The limits of imagination emerge when it tries to perceive and comprehend infinite nature through an aesthetic judgment of magnitude, because this judgment is what Deleuze now calls an evaluation of rhythm, by which he means it is an experience of continual variation, that is, comparison. So this judgment of magnitude, this attempt to measure the measure, if you like, it's actually, according to Deleuze, a kind of evaluation of a rhythm, of a continually changing, yeah, comparative process of comparison. Furthermore, because the experience of the sublime is formless, it also evades the object form of the understanding, the object equals X. So the sublime cannot appear under the concept of an object, yeah, because it is not measurable in a conceptual sense. And this destroys the free play of the faculties underlying our common sense. In other words, this undetermined relationship between the understanding and imagination, which gave rise to aesthetic judgments. In the face of the sublime, such judgments are no longer possible because the experience does not conform to the conceptual model of an object, the object equals X. This is a crucial moment because here we see very clearly Deleuze's method of what I called in the first lecture ventriloquism, this kind of way that Kant becomes a sort of hand puppet of Deleuze. So if we look at the next quote, we can see what Deleuze does, because it's at this moment of the sublime, that Deleuze finds in Kant the collapse of Kant's own system. So this is what Deleuze says. We have seen that aesthetic was, even though Kant does not say it, but it is what he is thinking of, was the grasping of rhythm as basis of measure and the unit of measure. Now, the concept of rhythm is a very important one in Deleuze and Deleuze and Guattari, and we'll come back to it later on in the course. But what I think is particularly interesting here in this quotation is this comment of Deleuze, even though Kant does not say it, but it is what he is thinking of. Yeah? This is kind of typical of the way that Deleuze is approaching philosophers. So it's finding, as I said before, it's finding in Kant, in a very close reading of Kant, in a new reading of Kant, the way that Kant collapses his own system, and the way that Kant's system is going to collapse on itself. So this is precisely the way that we might, as Deleuze said, read an enemy. Yeah? That it doesn't mean you don't pay attention, it doesn't mean that you're not doing a very careful, scholarly and careful reading. You're doing a reading which is going to kind of open up a hole in the philosopher's system. And it's going to be a kind of a hole or a collapse of the Kantian system that is really going to be, if you like, the foundation of Deleuze's own aesthetics theory, which is what we're going to go on to look at. Alright, so this fact, what Deleuze suggests is a fact about Kant's aesthetic, that it is a grasping, that at its base there is this grasping of rhythm as the unit of measure. This, Deleuze says, is a double disaster for Kant's system, because it means, on the one hand, I can't really measure the measure, not in any kind of universal sense, and I can't base the measure upon any a priori concept. And this ungrounded, subjective, invariable measure is actually what Kant wants to put forward as the ground, but Deleuze says it's also the ungrounding of perception. Deleuze writes, beneath the measure there is the rhythm, but this is a catastrophe. Deleuze draws a very radical conclusion from this. He writes, this is the next quotation on the page, my whole structure of perception is in the process of exploding. Why? My whole structure of perception is in the process of exploding because we have seen that this whole perceptive synthesis found its foundation in aesthetic comprehension, which is to say, the evaluation of rhythm. Here, it's as if this aesthetic comprehension as evaluation of a rhythm that would serve as a foundation of measure, thus the synthesis of perception, is compromised, drowned in a chaos, the sublime. Okay, so this is a very important moment for the continuation of Deleuzian, the Deleuzian aesthetic, because it places chaos in this kind of double-sided position of being, on the one hand, the ground of perception, but on the other hand, the ungrounding of perception. Now, this is going to come back to this concept of common sense that I've spoken about before. It's going to be this strange kind of condition, but also non-condition of human perception. It's going to be the basis of human perception, which is in itself inhuman. And this is going to be directly where Deleuze is going to place the sensation produced by a work of art, in this position which it is a sensation which must be perceived, but the perception itself of this sensation is going to lead by necessity to an inhuman experience. Okay, let's see if we can work out how this works. So, Deleuze finds in the sublime the appearance of a chaotic infinity as the foundation of perception itself, as the transcendental condition of the given discovered through the process of immanent critique, and so a foundation of human perception that is in itself inhuman and beyond the human. This inhuman foundation of human perception is revealed to us in the experience of the sublime. What is especially important here is that it is aesthetic experience that gives the sublime, which means it is in a sensation that the chaotic nature of nature is revealed. It's not a concept, it's not an idea of reason, it's not an act of the will, it's not an act of the intellectual mind, it is a sensation, a feeling. It is through sensation that we are going to experience this kind of ground, non-ground, that is chaos. And now we see also the way in which aesthetics is becoming very close to, if not indiscernible from, ontology, because in order to understand what an aesthetic experience is, we're going to have to understand what the ontology of chaos is. In other words, what is the nature of this chaos? This is not going to be exactly the topic that Deleuze addresses in relationship to Kant, but it's going to be a topic which nevertheless occupies him for a great deal of his career afterwards. Okay, so in the sublime, nature no longer obeys the same rules as perception, as in the experience of the beautiful, but instead ungrounds the faculties that determine our humanity. In the sublime, Deleuze argues, it is the inhuman sensation that appears to us. This is precisely what Deleuze and Guattari are going to argue more specifically about art in, for example, What is Philosophy? All this stuff about the ungrounding of the human and so forth and so on, this is, Deleuze finds this in Kant, because Kant talks extensively about the way in which our own subjectivity kind of is destroyed and disintegrates in the face of the sublime, that we are unable to process this sense experience, that we do not have, our faculties are unable to deal with it. Yeah, we can't grasp it, we can't give it a form, and the experience we have of it, completely unlike the experience of beauty and the pleasure we have in beauty, the experience we have of the sublime is simply of our own inadequacy to even represent it. Yeah? It goes beyond our ability of having a kind of coherent experience. Now, that's Kant, it's not Deleuze. So I just want to say that, just to say it's not just Deleuze kind of reading all this stuff into Kant. Yeah, it's a close reading, and it stays close to Kant's text, as Deleuze's readings always do. It's just the way that he kind of pushes it and massages it that produces these rather surprising results. Okay, but for Kant, it's not, the sublime is not this total disaster that maybe I've kind of made it out to be. Because he argues that to say something is absolutely large does presuppose a standard for the aesthetic judgment of magnitude, even though the standard cannot be found in imagination, as it refers to an absolute totality. So Kant's going to say, okay, so we can't deal with this experience through the faculty of the imagination. The imagination cannot comprehend this experience. But nevertheless, it is possible for us to... it is possible for us to grasp this experience, but it's going to be through another faculty, not the imagination, it's not going to be the understanding, but it's going to be through the faculty of reason. Although it is nature that reduces our imagination to impotence, it will actually be this impotence that forces us, Kant says, to unite the immensity of the sensible world into a whole, but it cannot. We cannot do this through the imagination, but we can do it through reason. Reason, as we know, seeks an idea of a suprasensible totality, something which cannot itself be sensed, but nevertheless exists, that underlies sensible experience. This is how Kant puts it. This is the next quote on the page. Yet this inadequacy, the inadequacy of the imagination in the face of the sublime, is the arousal in us of the feeling that we have within us a supersensible power, and what is absolutely large is not an object of sense, but is the use that judgments make naturally of certain things so as to arouse this feeling, and in contrast with that use any other, and in contrast with that use, any other use is small. Sublime is what even to be able to think proves that the mind has a power surpassing any standard of sense. So Kant wants to say, okay, so the experience of the sublime goes beyond the powers of the imagination, but in going beyond the powers, it reveals a higher power, and that is going to be the power of reason.
Excuse me? Is this like thinking of a geometrical feature? Like when I think of the absolute biggest possible triangle, it still stays a triangle? Doesn't matter how big I have to imagine, it stays the geometrical figure of a triangle? Is this like this?
No, because this would be a concept.
Ah, okay. So no reason.
Okay, so we've got to stay within the realms of the third critique, which is the realm of feeling. That's what Kant is looking for here. He's looking for the universal a priori grounds of a feeling of pleasure or displeasure. And so it's not going, the understanding is only going to come into it, concepts, it's only going to come into it on the level at which it is involved in this kind of undetermined free play with the imagination in determining an object of experience. Yeah? So the understanding is required because there has to be this concept of object equals X, the object form, if you like, conceptual form, in order for me to be able to experience an object. But apart from that, the understanding is not going to be active within the realm of the aesthetic or within the realm of judgment. It's about feeling. So the question of the failure of the imagination to apprehend the sublime is going to show, Kant argues, that there is another faculty which can, if you like, take over at that point at which imagination fails. And that is the faculty of reason, which is the faculty which is always searching for the noumena, the things in themselves, these suprasensible entities, which can which encompass the totality of things. So these are the concepts such as we saw in the relationship to the analytic of the beautiful, which was the totality of nature, the way that all objects in nature are interrelated and connected. This is an idea of reason. It's not an experience. We can't experience this yet. But we can experience the perfection of a form of an object of nature which reveals, let's say, this perfection or this idea to us.
The sublime is an idea of our...
No, the sublime is an experience. Yeah, it's an overwhelming experience, an experience that, let's say, overwhelms our ability to experience. Yeah? But it is going to reveal, which I'll carry on and explain, this is Kant now.
But it's not an idea of our reason.
Yes, it's going to reveal how reason is able to, let's say, take up from that moment where imagination fails in order to show us what, for example, the idea of the absolutely large could be and how it could operate. All right, let's see if we can
Can I add one?
Yes.
Because we have the ability, the faculty of I call it comparison now, we are able actually to go to the absolute, to think the absolute, because of this thinking of the sublime. It's kind of compare things as well with the infinite. Then, because of this feature, we are able to.
No, because of the breakdown, because there is no measure of the measure. So there is no absolute unit by which we could measure all other measurements within the realm of the imagination. So it means that when we're faced with the sublime, which is something which is absolutely large, the imagination is simply unable to give it a form. It's not... It's an experience which is not able to be, let's say, comprehended as a thing or as an object. We can't process this experience into a thing or an object that we can recognize or name. Yeah? Because it is absolutely large, it goes beyond all possible measurement, even if this measurement is, let's say, comparative. So comparative measurement is infinite because there is always a higher, there is always something larger that can come after any unit. Yeah? So if the sublime is the absolutely large, then it cannot be measured. So Kant wants to say, okay, so the sublime escapes, if you like, or goes beyond the limits of what the imagination is capable of doing. But yeah, at that point, the faculty of reason, if you like, steps in, because it's the faculty of reason which is precisely able to give us ideas that are no longer objects of experience, but which are suprasensible, yeah, or supersensible. But I need to try and explain how that works, so maybe it'll be clearer after that. It is through the sublime that the imagination finds the ideas of reason as what is beyond its limit. The sublime therefore reveals a direct subjective relationship between imagination and reason, but rather than being a free play of the faculties underlying our common sense, this is a relation of dissenses rather than an accord, a relation of contradiction between the demands of reason and the power of the imagination. Deleuze calls it a harmony in pain. Deleuze had a strong interest in masochism and wrote a book about it, in fact, and also wrote many other things about sadomasochism. And this is kind of a... It would be interesting to do a kind of a book about the aesthetics of sadomasochism in philosophy, you know, so like sadomasochistic concepts. This is like one of them. So, you know, he wants to say, okay, that the sublime, it's a harmony in pain that is between imagination and reason. And going beyond its own limit, imagination represents to itself in a negative fashion the inaccessibility but also the infinity of the ideas, and makes this inaccessibility present in nature. It's a kind of negative representation, yeah? That imagination represents the sublime to itself as what it cannot represent. Yeah? This is this fascinating moment in the Third Critique that so many people have been interested in, you know, especially, for example, Derrida, Lyotard, so forth and so on. This moment of kind of paradox, yeah, that the imagination presents to itself what it cannot present. Yeah. Deleuze is, of course, going to read it a bit differently from Derrida, also from Lyotard. Deleuze puts it like this: imagination awakens reason as the faculty able to conceive a supersensible substratum for the infinity of the sensible world. This is, and of course this is also the famous formulation of it, this is the presentation of the unpresentable. This is what the imagination achieves in the sublime, is the presentation of the unpresentable. This is exactly this kind of paradoxical and indeterminable structure that Derrida, for example, is so interested in. Kant writes, this is the next quotation, "This thrusting aside of the sensible barriers gives an imagination a feeling of being unbounded, and that removal is thus a presentation of the infinite." This is exactly, of course, what Kant has just shown to be impossible, that the imagination could be able to give a representation of infinity. But nevertheless, it is precisely this impossibility which kind of unleashes the imagination, gives it this feeling of being unbounded. "The sublime," he says, "raises the soul's fortitude above its usual middle range and allows us to discover in ourselves an ability to resist." That is, an ability to resist the kind of horror of infinity, the horror of the formless, the unbounded. "This is the power of reason, which has infinity under it as a unit, meaning," this is Kant again, "we found in our mind a superiority over nature itself in its immensity." Lucky for that. Of course, Deleuze, he doesn't want to find something in our mind that shows our superiority to nature. That's kind of the point. So Deleuze is enamored, I would say, of this experience of the sublime, and in actual fact he wants to broaden it to all, let's say, true aesthetic experience. So he's going to take this kind of idea of the sublime not as, let's say, the return of human superiority, but as the beginning of human dissolution, or perhaps human irrelevance. So, the sublime is an aesthetic experience, but it is one very different from the beautiful. In judging an object beautiful, the mind exercises itself, Kant says, in restful contemplation. Whereas in judging an object sublime, we enter, again this is Kant, into a mental agitation. So let's try to understand this difference between the beautiful and its restful contemplation and the sublime and its mental agitation. Both the beautiful and the sublime presuppose we make a reflexive judgment connecting empirical experience and its universal condition. That is the beginning, in fact, of the whole project of the third critique. In the first, the beautiful, our liking of an object is connected to the power of the imagination, such that when an intuition is given, it harmonizes with, rather than being determined by, the power of understanding, and we feel pleasure in the free play of the imagination and the understanding. Furthermore, this harmony of the faculties defining the beautiful reveals the common purpose of nature and of aesthetic judgment, inasmuch as both are expressed in the form of an object, understood as its line or design, rather than in its sensations of colour or sound. I alluded to this before. I don't know if we've really got time to talk about this at length, but there is in the Third Critique this very interesting historical moment where you have, in the analysis of the beautiful, a very classical understanding of beauty, which is defined in terms of its form. Yeah, so beauty is about beautiful form. In other words, it's about the outline of the form. But with the sublime, we have the emergence of something else, which is formless. Yeah? Something which is formless and which goes beyond our ability to comprehend its formal beauty. And this is the sort of beginnings of German Romanticism. If you read the description of Kant's descriptions of the sublime in the reader, it's sometimes as if you're reading a description of a romantic painting. The landslides, the thunderstorms, the lightning strikes, and so forth and so on. And it's a historical fact that the romantic painters and poets were reading very carefully Kant. And Deleuze discusses in other places, for example, the kind of brilliant and important reading of Kant that is done by Herderlein. So this is also a time when philosophy and art is in a much, in a very sort of close relation. But this critique of judgment, the Third Critique, is this kind of transitional work, a kind of a work that contains both classical aesthetics and romantic aesthetics, kind of almost, you know, it's like a train crash, you know, it's as if they're just directly kind of smashing into each other. In the sublime, however, we are confronted with a formless object, an absolutely large or infinite object, which presents an unboundedness. The beautiful is an exhibition of an undetermined concept of the understanding, but the sublime is an exhibition of an undetermined concept of reason. So rather than expressing the shared laws of nature and human aesthetic experience expressed in the production of harmonious form, the sublime expresses their radical difference, their incommensurability. Nature and human experience, or the faculties of human experience, are revealed in the sublime to be, let's say, connected only through their disconnection. This is what causes our mental agitation in the face of the sublime. The mind is both attracted and repelled by it. The mind sees something supersensible within it, an idea of reason, an idea of the absolutely large, nature in its totality, but it cannot grasp the supersensible idea itself as it lies beyond the imagination's power of presentation. And this, Kant says, produces a negative pleasure. A negative pleasure. In being judged beautiful, art is in harmony with nature. It appears according to the same rules as nature, according to the same purposiveness. But the sublime does not appear according to these rules of judgment. It appears beyond our forms of experience and doesn't take a sensible form because it's formless. Kant argues that in the sublime, the mind is induced to abandon sensibility and occupy itself with ideas containing a higher purposiveness. The mind is induced to abandon sensibility and occupy itself with ideas containing a higher purposiveness. The sublime lacks anything leading to particular objective principles and to a nature that conforms to them. This is Kant again. It is rather in its chaos that nature most arouses our ideas of the sublime. Okay, I'd like to read this long quotation that's in the pages I gave out now. This is Kant trying to explain this strange moment. If the human mind is nonetheless to be able even to think the given infinity without contradiction, it must have within itself a power that is supersensible, whose idea of a noumenon cannot be intuited, but can be regarded as the substrate underlying what is mere appearance, namely our intuition of the world. For only by means of this power and its idea do we, in a pure intellectual estimation of magnitude, comprehend the infinite in the world of sense entirely under a concept, even though in a mathematical estimation of magnitude by means of numerical concepts, we can never think it in its entirety. This relates to a distinction that Kant makes between the mathematical sublime and the dynamical sublime, but I haven't really talked about that because it doesn't directly intersect with what I'm trying to talk about in terms of Deleuze. Even a power that enables us to think the infinite of supersensible intuition as given in our intelligible substrate surpasses any standard of sensibility. Now, the proper, unchangeable, basic measure of nature is the absolute whole of nature, which in the case of nature as appearance is infinity comprehended. This basic measure, however, is a self-contradictory concept, because an absolute totality of an endless progression is impossible. Hence, that magnitude of a natural object to which the imagination fruitlessly applies its entire ability to comprehend, must lead the concept of nature to a supersensible substrate, which underlies both nature and our ability to think, a substrate that is large beyond any standard of sense and hence makes us judge as sublime, not so much the object as the mental attunement in which we find ourselves when we estimate the object. So, it makes us judge as sublime not so much the object as the mental attunement in which we find ourselves when we estimate the object. So, once more, Kant is not trying to show something that about what exists in the world, he's trying to show how it is that we experience objects in the world, and how we experience these aesthetic objects, and finally how and the meaning of our experience of the sublime. It also leads to a mental attunement, an attunement this time between the imagination, which cannot experience the sublime, and reason, which can, let's say, comprehend it. In judging something beautiful, the feeling of the sublime is a feeling of displeasure arising from imagination's inadequacy in its aesthetic estimation of magnitude. But at the same time, it is also a pleasure, because this judgment that the greatest power of sensibility is inadequate is in harmony with reason. So our realization that our imagination is inadequate to deal with the sublime actually is in harmony with the higher faculty of reason. Reason, the law of reason is its striving, or the purpose of reason, let's say, is its striving towards the absolute totality of ideas, the absolute totality. So it's this harmony between the inadequacy of the imagination, which nevertheless reveals, let's say, the necessity of reason. This is what Kant calls our supersensible vocation, our perception that every standard of sensibility is inadequate for the estimation of an absolute magnitude, is itself in harmony with the laws of reason. As a result, the displeasure or agitation we experience when our imagination is inadequate to presenting the sublime reveals our supersensible vocation and so is purposive. It reveals our higher purpose. And this, finally, is pleasurable. Imagination and reason are therefore in harmony in the sublime, Kant writes, by virtue of their contrast. Can someone tell me the time?
It's 20 after 2.
20 after 2, okay, we're going well. Deleuze describes this in the following way. This is the next quotation on your pages. When imagination is confronted with its limit by something which goes beyond it in all respects, it goes beyond its own limit itself, admittedly in a negative fashion, by representing to itself the inaccessibility of the rational idea and by making this very inaccessibility something which is present in sensible nature. As Kant puts it, this thrusting aside of the sensible barriers gives the imagination a feeling of being unbounded, and that removal is thus a presentation of the infinite. In confronting its limit in the sublime, imagination reveals the dominance of reason over sensibility and expands sensibility towards the infinite, which for sensibility is an abyss. Kant writes, this is the next quotation, "The sublime can be described thus. It is an object of nature, the presentation of which determines the mind to think of nature's inability to attain to an exhibition of ideas. In the sublime, we're compelled to think of nature as an exhibition of something supersensible without being able to bring this about objectively. In this strain on imagination, we have the feeling that the mind has a vocation that transcends the domain of nature and that this presentation is subjectively purposive, that this is, in fact, our subjective purpose. The sublime," Kant says, "gives us soul-stirring sensations. In the sublime, the soul is felt as the indeterminate, supersensible unity of all the faculties. In the sublime, the supersensible destination of our faculties appears as that to which a moral being is predestined." Kant writes, "What we call sublime in nature outside us, or for that matter in nature within us, becomes interesting only because we present it as a might of the mind to rise above certain obstacles of sensibility by means of moral principles." Deleuze is especially interested in the sublime because it is there, he argues, that the syntheses of the imagination, which placed sensible experience under the legislation of the categories of the understanding, breaks down. At this moment, experience is no longer determined by its forms of possibility, whether this is objective, as is the case in perception, or whether this is subjective, as is the case with our aesthetic experience of the beautiful. Deleuze says, this is the last quotation on the page, "I'm saying that the schema and the synthesis are operations which, in a certain way, put a conceptual determination and a spatio-temporal determination into relation. But then it's as if the synthesis will be shattered, pierced, will be overcome by a stupefying adventure which is the experience of the sublime. The experience of the sublime will knock over all the syntheses. It will be the critique of judgment in his last book, as if to the extent he aged, he became aware of the catastrophe of the sublime, the sublime crushes me and our whole ground, the whole ground of our knowledge which we have constructed with syntheses and schemas, starts to shake. But Deleuze is interested in the sublime because it is the way in which art, as sensation, overcomes the limits of human perception by giving a sensation that goes beyond them. So the sensation that art gives for Deleuze-Guattari goes beyond human sensibility. We know, we remember, the percept is beyond human perception, the affect is beyond human affection. Yeah? So in this sense, it's very close to the third critique. Yeah? This sensation, the sublime sensation, is precisely what goes beyond the limits of our experience, and it goes, more importantly, beyond the limits of possible experience. It goes beyond the conceptual conditions of possibility under which we even have an experience. So if a sensation goes beyond the conditions of human perception, what is this beyond? As we have seen, for Kant, it is the supersensible ideas of reason that is beyond and revealed in this beyond, or by this beyond, if you like, of the imagination. But Deleuze is going to reject this transcendental idea of Kant as being too transcendent, too determining of the particular, and for returning us to a kind of transcendental, but nevertheless still human, subjectivity, which Kant calls the soul. The sublime reveals a transcendental realm as the condition of experience, the realm of ideas. But this realm seems to simply reproduce the human subject. This is Deleuze's argument. It reproduces the human subject, even if this transcendental subjectivity is called a soul rather than a subject. We'll come back to this criticism that Deleuze makes of Kant in relationship to phenomenology, because Deleuze is going to say that phenomenology, well, it's basically just Kant, right? And so I'll talk more about this idea of transcendental subjectivity, its roots in Kant, and the way that it was used and transformed in phenomenology in some weeks. But despite Deleuze's rejection, despite the fact that Deleuze rejects this Kantian appeal to reason through the sublime, he does believe that nature is composed of ideas. So but they are what he calls problematic ideas, meaning they are not yet known and are only expressed through particular empirical experiences. Now, this again is going to be another crucial way that Deleuze is kicking off, if you like, from Kant, because he's very interested, obviously, in the reflective judgment. Because for Deleuze, he always wants to start from empirical experience, from what is, in order to understand what its no longer conditions of possible experience might be, but what he calls its following Salomon Neyman, the conditions of real experience. So Deleuze is interested in a transcendental field which acts as the condition for experience, but these are not conceptual or, let's say, moral conditions of possible experience. These are what he calls conditions of real experience. For Deleuze, singular events of sensation presuppose transcendental conditions. These are what he calls problematic ideas, that are, however, not outside experience and do not act as its conditions of possibility, but instead enter into a relation of reciprocal determination with actuality. This is the realm of what Deleuze calls the virtual, which is the realm of ideas understood not as a priori, necessary, and universal laws, but as shifting differential relationships, pure differences, between forces and material that are expressed in real experience and whose actual expression feeds back and changes their transcendental conditions. So I spoke of this before. In Deleuze, there are these, let's say, two dimensions of the actual world, the world of experience, and the world of and the dimension of this world's transcendental conditions, the virtual world. But Deleuze is wanting to prevent any kind of real separation of these dimensions. So these dimensions are in what he calls reciprocal determination. It means that even though the virtual provides the conditions for emergence or for a particular singular experience, this experience is going to feed back into its transcendental conditions and actually change them as well. So there will be this constant kind of circuit from virtual to actual, which cannot be broken and cannot be separated. Yeah? That there is going to be this indiscernibility, this simultaneity, I'll talk more about it as we go on, between the expression of the virtual in the actual, but also the construction of the virtual by the actual. This constant kind of circulation that is going to form what Deleuze calls a plane of immanence, yeah? Or sometimes he calls it a plane of consistency. There are lots of other words he uses as well, depending on which philosopher or person he's talking about. But the idea is always to try and flatten these dimensions, to try and get them as close together as possible, to the point, for example, in the cinema books, where he's going to talk about the time image as being the smallest possible gap between the virtual and the actual, to the point of their very indiscernibility. Okay, I'll talk more about this as we go along, because obviously it's very important, but it's also a very interesting question in relationship to the full trajectory of Deleuze's career, because it seems, at least to me and some other people, that the book that up until Deleuze's meetings with Guattari, this, let's say, Kantian relationship between the transcendental, virtual, and the actual realm, retains a kind of a separation which the work after Guattari attempts to dissolve. Yeah, so there would be a kind of a break within Deleuze's corpus that would be of a important ontological nature, that up until really difference in repetition, logic of sense, there is a strong sense in which there is a necessary separation between virtual and actual, and that all genetic operations, that is, the agent of change, is always held on the level of the virtual, and it is actualized in the real world, but in being actualized, it is also cancelled. So we could imagine that this is a more Kantian kind of formulation, because it incorporates a kind of sense in which there is a presentation of the unpresentable, that the virtual determines or is actualized in the world in terms of the becoming or change of the world, but that in being actualized, it is itself cancelled and no longer present. Yeah? This is the kind of structure which is explored in difference and repetition and logic of sense. Then the next book after those is Anti-Oedipus with Guattari, the virtual and the actual as terminology almost entirely goes out and is replaced by much more material kind of vocabulary drawn obviously from psychoanalysis, but also from Artaud, the body without organs, nature, Spinoza comes back. Okay. I'll talk more about this as we go along. All right. So, the virtual and the actual make up a single plane of immanence, nature in its widest sense, and it is their reciprocal determination, or what Deleuze calls transcendental empiricism. Now, this is a word that is often used to describe Deleuze's philosophy, and it kind of gives a suggestion of the way in which Deleuze both draws from, but also departs from, Kant. Yeah? It's a transcendental philosophy, but it is an empiricism. It is about, it begins from particular experience, and particular experience is not separable or distinct from, yeah, its transcendental conditions. So sensations are always asubjective and inhuman because, like the sublime, their affects and percepts go beyond the limitations of human perception and affection in expressing the transcendental virtual realm. In other words, in expressing and actualizing these differential relations. In doing so, an actual sensation expresses a virtual idea as its transcendental but nevertheless real condition, meaning that ideas do not exist outside of their expression, and that their expression could also be said to construct. In Kant, the variation of empirical experience is limited by its pure and unchanging forms of possibility, whereas in Deleuze, there are no forms of possibility, only real conditions that vary along with their actual expression. For Deleuze, virtual ideas are multiplicities of pure variations, or rhythms. So this is why rhythm is so important for Deleuze, because rhythm is going to become the term that describes differential relations. There is relations of different terms. Virtual ideas are multiplicities of pure variations that require actualization and sensations for their complete determination. But before sensation itself exceeds the human limits of sensibility, and this is what Kant's sublime demonstrates to Deleuze, the real conditions, it means the transcendental conditions of experience, only appear in an actual experience that goes beyond the human form. As in Kant, sensation reveals to us the infinite plane of nature, but in Deleuze, this realm is not determined by a priori conditions, whether these are the forms of experience in general or the ideas of reason. Instead, the plane of nature is that of life, understood as the constantly variable relation of virtual ideas or differences and their actual expressions. Everything, life itself, is in a process of becoming that is constantly expressing and constructing itself across and between the virtual and actual dimensions. For Kant, the identity of phenomena is mirrored by the identity and fixity of the transcendental conditions. For Deleuze, the non-identifiable variation of sensation expresses and constructs the pure variation of the transcendental, now understood as a single and all-encompassing plane of immanence. So, it will be to the plane of immanence that we will now turn in the next 2 weeks as we examine Nietzsche's will to power and then Spinoza's God nature. Okay, any questions? No. All right, we'll see you next week.